Stephen Darrell. I'm a retired academic, author, investigative journalism. My specialisation is really British intelligence, specifically MI6. And I have written extensively on Northern Ireland and intelligence. And I've also written a book on Harold Wilson, on the plotting against him in the 60s and 70s. And I am currently starting to put together an updated version with new material.
So what's the title of the book?
I don't know yet. I don't know.
Or the old book, at least, if people want to get
hold of it. The old book was Smear, co-written with Robin Ramsey, Wilson and the Secret State.
You talking about investigative journalism there reminds me, Adam Curtis, the filmmaker, documentary maker, he said about 6 or 7 years ago, not long after his Power of Nightmares film, that he thought that journalism was dead these days because the changes that had taken place in the media following the Thatcher years, the 80s and in the 90s, meant that actually journalists weren't really... It was almost like all the stories were cutting out the middleman. The whoever was generating the story or to do with the story it was going straight to the news bulletins without really any journalists getting involved along the way much.
I think he's correct. I did help with the documentary he did on David Sterling, which I thought was good. I've been quoted a number of times. I said something, I was about 20 years ago, I think I said something along the lines of that investigative journalism started in the 60s, developed in the 70s, became popular in the 80s, and is now dead. And the internet has revived it to some extent, and there are some good things being done, but I don't think it has the impact that it did. And it's a kind of paradox, really, that we've got all this information, the internet and all the rest of it, but I don't think that's really helped investigative journalism away, because I think it's become, the whole media thing's just a kind of spectacle, and it's very difficult to get real in-depth investigative journalism to the public. You know, cuts to TV, lack of documentaries, newspapers, and there are some really good online things, but who sees them?
Well, sometimes quite a lot of people do. I mean, I would agree with you. I think it's just that you used to have production offices who even had, some of them had full-time barristers helping them with getting through the legal problems, and that's just not happening at all anymore. You know, thinking about series like World in Action, Roger Cook, and his Cook Report, and these programs really were, but they don't. I mean, it was. I remember Tim Tate, who was a producer at the time, saying this was quite a fragile ecosystem, and it was just dismantled. So that the golden age of, I suppose, everyone's got a television in their house now, or most people do, although some of them are discarding them. And once everyone's got a TV, you don't need to make it have such an appeal. But one of the people is interesting, I think, recently, and I've been using some of his material, is a guy called Mark Felton. He's a military historian who goes into all sorts of interesting tales. For example, people who were working with British intelligence who had married Nazis, who then were given a kind of cover and lived for many years, even though these people were implied in war crimes and things like that. So all sorts of interesting stuff he's come out with. But what I'd like to talk to you about is his latest film on Clockwork Orange and the coup attempts against the Harold Wilson government. So I know you've written a book about it, and you're also working on another one. So, and you've watched Felton's piece on this. So I just wonder if you can give us a bit of a review, say what you liked about it, and maybe if he didn't get a few things right.
Well, I really like Mark Felton's stuff. I do watch the wartime things on YouTube, and they're always fascinating. So it's interesting he's moved into kind of post-war things. But we happen to share the same literary agent. So I do know the basis of some of this because I had some involvement in the chapter on the 1968 alleged coup involving Cecil King. And I've watched it, and I think basically it's fine. It starts off with the incident at Heathrow in the mid-70s when troops appeared. And it's certainly true that Wilson was paranoid at that stage because he hadn't been told about this particular event.
So can we just say something about the context here? Because Harold Wilson was had turned up as a very, actually quite popular Labour Prime Minister. And I think he won quite a few general elections, but it was during the sort of Beatles era, that kind of 1960s and 70s, when the politics was quite finely balanced between people like Heath and Wilson. And also there were enormous changes of deindustrialisation and anti-union activity going on, which was culminated, I suppose, with the 80s and Thatcher. But this was a bit of a battle going on, wasn't it, between Labour and Tory in Westminster?
Yeah, well, Wilson, actually, if you look at lists of prime ministers, is always near the top. He was a very popular prime minister, and he won four elections, which is unheralded. And he had to survive on very slim majorities, except for the 66 one. But he came in 64, partly on the back of the Profumo affair, which he played a key role in exposing it in Parliament. And I think they had expected to get a bigger majority, but they ended up with four. But they managed to keep going, and it was a difficult time, and there was problems with the Americans over Vietnam, and I think most people from that period are really glad that Wilson kept Britain out of the Vietnam War, because there was lots of pressure to do that. And part of the reason for being keeping out of the Vietnam War and the negotiations with the Americans was that the economy was starting to go into trouble. The Tories had expanded the economy in the early 60s, and inflation was starting in other aspects. And he needed the basically the backing of the dollar from the Americans. Otherwise, he would have to devalue, and he knew that electorally that would be a problem. So there was a complicated thing going on, alliance with the Americans, which is kind of interesting in the light of what's going on today. But it was a good period for the British economy in one way, in that the working class did well. It was the last period of social mobility, except for a couple of years in the mid-70s when Wilson was in again. Social mobility is gone. And also the wages of what was known as the aspiring working class were very good. They were rising after the immediate post-war period, and the working class economically was doing fine. And certainly up until the mid-70s, it was doing the best ever. And in fact, you could argue the working class has never recovered from that. So there were a lot of people very happy with Wilson. But he was disliked personally by the Tories. You know, the line was, he was too clever by half. And in fact, he was very clever. He was one of the brightest ever students at Oxford.
Well, the implication is that they weren't.
That they weren't. Well, yeah, the Tories.
They weren't clever. Yeah, he was cleverer than them. So they didn't
like
him.
He was cleverer than them. He knew what was happening, and he had ideas about how to do it. But I think how to kind of grow the economy, which currently nobody seems to have any ideas. But that was a battle with in fact, the city, which in some ways was represented by the Bank of England and Cromer, who's head of it. And the mouthpiece, in lots of ways, was Cecil King at the Sunday Mirror. King actually didn't own the paper or anything, but he took on the role of a press baron. He had been pro Labour, but he didn't like Wilson, and he started in the mid 60s to dislike the economic policies. And he was starting in 67, in 68 to campaign against Wilson on a level of internal politics. He liked other people inside the Labour Party, and the Labour Party has always been riven by these different factions.
Well, it might be that Cecil King would have rather liked to see somebody like Owen Smith or Keir Starmer in charge of the Labour Party.
I'm not sure about that, actually. I think he would have thought that they weren't that bright. Because one of the things you have to remember is that Wilson was popular. He was a good prime minister and all the rest of it, very clever. But there were some really good people in the Labour Party at that particular time. You know, whatever your politics, there could have been three or four other choices of leader. He had Jenkins, who made his name with the civil liberties agenda in the 60s, which is still with us to this day. He really made the kind of social world that we live in terms of divorce, abortion, all those kind of social things. Callaghan was on the right, but he was a big figure in the party. You had Crossman, Crossland, and you had the rising figure of Tony Benn. So, and also Barbara Castle, who was hugely popular. So Wilson was fighting the kind of economic establishment and also trying to keep the party together on an incredibly slim majority. And they got through 66, won the election, they got a bigger majority, and things started to go well, except they did have to devalue the pound. There was no getting away from that, that the kind of empire or remnants of that were a huge drag on the economy. And the kind of economic industrial system was really starting to get backward. Japan, Germany had forged ahead post-war, invested a lot of money. Britain didn't. It's still spent a huge sum on defence, which kind of took away money from investment in what Wilson wanted to do, which was the white heat of technology and all that.
Well, I mean, there's echoes of today there, maybe. But let's get back to Felton's piece, because there's a couple of things he talks about which are really, I think, key to understanding what was going on there. One is this business of Cecil King trying to get his piece in the Mirror, which was basically backing the establishment over the elected government. And then there's also this meeting where various people stormed out saying that it was treasonous and that they shouldn't be having it. So did all these things happen, and how do they fit in?
Some of it happened. It's very difficult to know precisely because the records are either not there or the records that we do have clearly been rewritten or written in the knowledge that this is history and somebody's going to read them in the future. So quite exactly what went on is not clear. But we know by the beginning of 68, Cecil King is determined to get rid of Wilson. Now, Cecil King has links into intelligence, partly through his the newspapers. The Mirror had newspapers in Africa, and they set up news agencies and things, and there was a close cooperation with British intelligence and also with IRD, Information Research Department, which was a semi-secret propaganda unit of the Foreign Office. He also had ties to a man called Harry Wharton, who was an MI5 officer and responsible for cooperation and connections to British newspapers. And Peter Wright talks about that year as being particularly important, 1968, and it was because of the Vietnam War, the big demonstrations and all the rest of it. And MI5, he says, was stirring things up. It's not exactly clear what that means, but part of that is stories in the press. And King is somebody who sees himself as something of a kingmaker, and he calls in Lord Mountbatten. He's looking for somebody who could lead a kind of technological government of people in the city, some bankers, industrialists, and somebody who has a link to the royal family. That is always seen as important. There had been It seems like rumors of a coup or actual meetings in 65. Now, a lot of this was around Rhodesia. Rhodesia had gone independent illegally, set up the Smith regime, which was a white regime. And Lord Blake, who was the historian of the Conservative Party, said the name Rhodesia is written on the heart of the Conservative Party in the 1960s. It split the party a lot between those who were upholding the constitution and this was illegal in Rhodesia and those who supported the white regime in Rhodesia. And some of those people were former MI6 people.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, but it's worth saying something about Cecil Rhodes and Rhodesia because this whole UDI thing, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, this was it's all to do with Britain losing its empire. It's almost as if these military types, royal types, king, etc., were seeing the empire slipping away and wanted somebody to blame it on.
Well, there was a section. It's quite a small section. It's the right wing of the Tory Party because the actual main people in the Conservative Party, particularly Macmillan, they didn't see it as losing the empire. They wanted rid of it because it's very clear the empire, particularly in Africa, was costing the British economy a lot of money. There had been a stage, obviously, where it was making money for the British economy, but when you get into the mid-50s, it actually costs money, and they want it out as quickly as possible. And the right wing of the Tory Party didn't, and this centred around Rhodesia and South Africa. And this becomes, for a decade, a major faction with ties to intelligence. And even the intelligence services themselves, MI6, is split on this because there are actually people inside MI6 who are very anti-South Africa and apartheid and Rhodesia and are helping the ANC in the background on this. And there's others, particularly in MI5, who just see them as all communists and they want to stop it. So it's a complicated thing. But Cecil King calls in Lord Mountbatten. And Mountbatten is obviously a big name, probably a narcissistic kind of personality. He likes to be seen as being important. He likes the idea of playing some kind of role. And he takes with him Lord Zuckerman, who is the chief scientist for the government, another big figure in kind of scientific circles, and they go and see King and Lord, not Lord, Cudlip is there as well, who's the editor of the Mirror. The accounts of what actually took place are somewhat contradictory, but essentially the idea is replace Wilson with a new government headed by Lord Mountbatten.
Let me
There
just say,
is.
sorry to interrupt you again, but the Mirror at the time, I suppose, because you've had the Mail as a sort of right populist paper, the Mirror was a much more left-wing populist paper with people like Paul Foot writing for it. And so I suppose the
Not at
idea
that
is that
stage.
the control of the most popular left-wing media at the time, newspapers, was considered absolutely instrumental in getting the public behind what was going on.
Some of that is true and some's not. The Mirror is an interesting newspaper because it does start off, 1945 is very pro-Labour. But when you get to the 60s, it's a different regime. And there are some odd things about it. I mean, the Cudlips themselves had intelligence connections. And I got a document about CIA connections to his brother, who was another journalist. And Cudlip had moved to the right, not in terms of the Labour Party. So he wasn't that pro-Wilson by that stage. Interestingly, of course, they set up, because this was Odhams Press, they set up The Sun in, was it 64? As a pro-working class, aspiring working class newspaper. And actually, for about 5 years, it was very good. We had it, and we were a very working class family. And it had a readership of about 1 million. but it wasn't making enough money for the Mirror Group, and so they ditched it. And the Mail at that stage wasn't the newspaper quite as we know it today, because actually we were talking about investigative journalism. One of the best investigative journalist units was on the Mail, which in the mid-60s had set one up, and as you said, had a barrister and all the rest of it, and doing things. So the there were changes going on in the media empire and the newspapers, and they were starting to change their political allegiances. So Kudlip did a version of this. There is a version from Zuckerman, and there is a slim version from Cecil King, which basically comes down to whether Mountbatten was serious or not. It seems that Mountbatten was intrigued by the idea, and Zuckerman kind of pulled him out of it. And it got to the stage where they supposedly talked about, well, this might bring machine guns on street corners in London and all that kind of thing. Now, the background of this was there were things going on in the military. There were people talking about maybe we have to intervene and do something. Now, we don't, and the report did go to MI5, which we've never seen, and we don't know what's in it. But they did do some investigations into this. Now, further back, the context of this is the Vietnam War and the anti-Vietnam demonstrations. The Grosvenor Square one, which was massive. And in the lead up to that, there were a number of strange things happened. There's now the inquiry into the SDS, the police squad infiltrating people into left-wing groups, which starts in 1968.
That's the special demonstration squad.
Yes. And I mean, we didn't know about this, but I did write a piece 20 years ago saying, look, there's some odd things going on here. It's clear that some of the left-wing groups were infiltrated. There were burglaries, there were fake posters for demonstrations, leaflets were put out. There was a guy called Vic Norris who appeared pretending to be on the left and brought out demonstrators, but he wasn't, he was on the right. There is an account by an MI5 officer called Ronnie Reed who says, actually, we infiltrated the main demonstration and one of the parts where there is a bit of violence going on was led by one of our men from MI5. And that was a Maoist group. When you see Maoist groups, you always worry because these tend to be the groups that are put in as false flag kind of things. And so there was a lot going on, and there's still things we don't know. We know that there were some stories planted, like in the Evening Standard through Special Branch, warning about violence, that there was going to be some people in the demonstration who were determined to make it violent. And Callahan did an investigation into this because he got worried and discovered, in fact, it was a false report and somebody had planted it with the newspaper. And there were these things going on, and this was going in the background of King. And King was a person who said he had grandiose ideas of himself, but he kind of had fears about the decline of society, about permissiveness, about, as you mentioned, the losing of empire, the falling economic standing of Great Britain, which was losing out particularly to Germany and the burgeoning European community. And so he was determined to do so. And there were some politicians within the Labour Party who wanted Wilson out. And there were some Tories who were willing to kind of join in a kind of national government. Now, at one stage, King actually had meetings with Oswald Mosley. He thought that Mosley might be somebody who could return and lead a new national government. So it was a very interesting time, socially, politically, world politics. And Wilson was trying to keep all this together. with an economy which was starting to turn bad, that we really didn't export enough, imports are going up, and the balance of payments. I mean, nobody really talks about the balance of payments anymore, but on the news, it was always the balance of payments. It didn't look good. And so Jenkins, who became the Chancellor...
Sorry, just to explain to people that what that is, the idea is the, you know, the wealth flowing into the country and out of the country...
Imports and exports.
Totted up every month to see... And of course, it was all going south, you know, because we were deindustrializing. People were making sensible, I suppose, the only policy decision you could make, which is to start to import much more.
Well, yeah. I mean, the real problem was lack of investment. We just did not invest. I mean, I came from Kidderminster, which was a carpet town, and the equipment there had been put in the beginning of the 19th century, and they hadn't changed it. You know, and then you start to get new carpets coming in from China and other places, which are much cheaper. And so you start to lose out, and that happens across the board, you know, shipping, all the rest of it. Just a lack of investment. But what happened was that the right, the free marketeers, who are starting to appear in the Tory party, are blaming the unions. They're blaming the trade unions. And that is what really takes off in the 70s, is the attack on trade unions, which they see as funding the Labour Party. They see people like Jack Jones, Scanlon, Gunter and others being very close to the Labour Party. And it breaks the consensus that there had been throughout the 50s, early 60s, with the Tories, Labour, that you cooperate with trade unions, you sit down, you have sandwiches, and, you know, beer and talking out. And now that's broken. And even Wilson is pushed that way by the seaman strike. He receives reports from MI5 about Communist Party infiltration and all the rest, that they're directing it. And some of that is true, but the real point is the trade unions become the thing that is blamed. The MI5 and groups like private groups like Common Cause, IRIS, Economic League are fed intelligence information, which they use in the media to attack trade unions. And so when you get to post-68, things are not going so well for the government. Jenkins is the exchequer, and he has to bring in some cuts, which do actually work, and the economy is starting to turn in end of 1969, and then they lose the 70 election. And some people think it's because of a particularly bad week on the balance of payments, when we buy in a load of aircraft from the Americans, and it makes the trade balance look really bad. So Wilson manages to keep the party together. He stays as leader, and Heath comes in, and really things go to pot with the 73 oil crisis. That really changes everything. And there are some economists, and I go along with it, that we've never really recovered. That the 73 oil crisis is the end of what became known as the golden age of the British economy, and in Germany, France, and whatever. And what happened was that British industry, the city, decided not to invest. They could see the way things were going, and they decided to take their money, basically.
Yeah, well, so the oil crisis was really triggered by the Yom Kippur War, with the Arab states, because we had supported the Israelis, you know, basically jacking up the price of oil massively. Yes. And the end result was, and I remember this, and I'm sure you do, is great long queues for people to get fuel. So as people in the 1960s have been persuaded to buy cars, by the time it comes to the mid-1970s, they're now thinking, oh, well, we're going to have to wait for like 3/4 of an hour just to get half a tank of fuel. But I mean, up until then, I think you're probably right that people's disposable income had been increasing, and you're suggesting maybe there that was the turning point when the fall, which has continued to this day, in people's disposable income, that purchasing power of jobs, that's kind of hit. You know, it's been downhill ever since.
Absolutely. Well, I happened to have been a petrol pump attendant in 1973. And I was there and watched these long queues, and I always remember some woman berating me, hitting me to put more petrol into a car. And I said, I can't, it's coming out. And people were mad. But the point was that brought down the Heath government, and it brought in the right free marketeers into the Tory party, the Thatcherites, as they became known. But the original group of those were right-wing Tories with links to, in particular, MI6, George Kennedy Young and others. And they started organising. They wanted Heath out as the leader, and they succeeded with that, and they wanted Wilson out, and they wanted a complete change of direction. And the British economy... I mean, inflation grew enormously. And Wilson, I think, did actually pretty well. I mean, we know now, because the International Monetary Fund was called in. There's a famous incident where Healey, who was another big figure in the Labour Party, could have become leader, was out of the country, and the pound was falling. And he decided to bring the IMF in, and he came back and he looked and he thought, actually, I don't think we need to. And he did write later that it was a big mistake. But that made the country look a basket case, the poor man of Europe and all the rest of it. And, of course, this is the decline in the 60s, at the end of the 60s, is one of the reasons why we went into Europe. I mean, a decision was made really in the early 60s post-Suez, when there was a meeting of Eden and his close advisors, and they had three options. They decided one was to continue as they were, but they said they couldn't do it. Britain simply isn't big enough or economically powerful enough to carry on its own, which is interesting in the light of Brexit. And the other one was to... go into Europe, because they were getting lots of reports from people who'd been to Europe and had discovered that the standard of living in Europe was higher than in Britain. And this happened.
Perish the thought. But anyway, look, can we wind up by just giving us maybe a star rating for Mark's attempt, and maybe say something about this title, Clockwork Orange?
Yeah, so I just finished that one point, that the third option... Because de Gaulle turned down going to Europe, the third option was to go with the Americans. But they only saw it as a short-term thing. So when they get into the 80s, into the 70s, they're very tied to the Americans and the American economic system, and it becomes difficult with Europe. But Clockwork Orange was a separate, totally separate thing. It was a propaganda campaign in two parts, or three and four parts, in fact, in Northern Ireland, firstly to deal with the IRA and planting false stories, a false narrative. The second one, Clockwork Orange 2, was smear campaigns against politicians, which were mostly Northern Ireland, but included Labour Party people. And interestingly, we now know that in 1976, Wilson was told about Clockwork Orange 2. He knew about it. He knew that there was a smear campaign going on against him and some of his closest colleagues. And some of this material made it into the press. And it's part of what becomes known as the plots against Wilson, which were not solely MI5. There were people inside MI5, outside. There were people in MI6 and outside, and some military people. And some of the MI5 people involved in that, a small, very small group, were the same people who had been involved in 1968 in steering up stuff with Cecil King.
Now, we started by talking about investigative journalism. Was there much going on at the time into this, or was it all secret?
Not into this at all until what became known as the Pencourt file in 76, when Wilson tried to reach out to journalists and said, look, there's something going on here and I need some help and I'll give you the story and you investigate it. And he tried the BBC, and he ended up with Barry Penrose and Roger Courtier, who were two young journalists. As Penrose told me, he said, at that time, we knew nothing about the intelligence services. You know, you just knew that they were there, but you didn't know who they were. You didn't know what they did. Nobody had written anything about them. So they were starting from scratch, and it was very difficult. But Wilson told them a lot, which they put into a book called The Pencourt File, which in retrospect is great. There's lots of leads, lots of stuff there. The media in general tried to kind of dismiss it. The kind of opinion of Wilson had turned. He remained very, very popular with the majority of people, but people in the media, I think, started to think, well, was it so great?
Can you just let people know whereabouts they can find you, follow you, Stephen?
They can't. I don't have a presence. There are books, This Smear, there's a history of MI6, there's a biography of Sir Oswald Mosley, there's a book on intelligence in the 80s and 90s, and a couple of books on the Profumo Affair, and I will be bringing out a book next year on Colin Wallace and Clockwork Orange.
Okay, well, Stephen Dorrell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.